Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavahai, Tejasvinapati Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Okay, there's a couple of questions here. But you don't have to have written a question. You can just ask also. So I'll look at these that I've received. Oh, this is good. How come we humans get to know knownness? How come we humans get to know knownness? Well, there's two things there. One is, when we say knownness, use this word known or knownness, we're really using that word because we use it in our daily life. This is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. And when we say that this is known, somehow we're assuming that the object, that the knownness somehow belongs to the object and not to the subject. Right? Like if I say, yeah, I know this, or this is known to me, and put it in passive tense, it's as though the object itself enjoys the quality of being known or knownness. But actually, the knownness belongs to the subject. And the subject, and we won't, in reference to the subject, we don't use that word. What we say is that consciousness itself is self-evident, you know, or self-shining, meaning it doesn't need another light to light it up. That's what we mean, swaprakasha. It's self-shining as consciousness. We also use the word swatasiddha. It's self-established. And what we mean, it's hard to translate that, but literally, swatasiddha, it's self-established, means that it does not require a pramana, a means of knowledge, in order for you to know it. In other words, any objectified object, right, requires to come into contact with consciousness. Right? It isn't consciousness itself. So in order for, like, this table or bent or whatever we call it, stool, in order for this stool to enjoy knownness, being known, it needs to come into contact with consciousness. And the way that it does that is through the use of a means of knowledge, like in this case it would be sense perception, for instance. That would create a vritti, a thought modification in the mind, in the form, which is taking on the nama-rupa, the name form, of this stool. Okay? And so the vritti, now we have the vritti, the thought modification of the stool in the mind, which is sattva, which has its own unique relationship with consciousness, which it as though reflects consciousness. And so when I can get through a means, any of my means of knowledge available to me, when I can get an experience into the vritti, that vritti enjoys the knownness of consciousness, and therefore this shines, this stool will shine. Or this stool will be known, or this stool will shine, you know, or present itself to me. But it cannot present itself to me from its own standpoint. Where consciousness itself doesn't require any kind of means of knowledge to come into contact with consciousness so that consciousness can be known. It is the knownness, in fact, it is the self-evident, self-shining consciousness which comes into contact with every vritti that I have. And the vrittis, the thought modifications that I have, are given to me through my means of knowledge. For instance, like sense perception is one of the five sense organs, or one means of knowledge. But there's many others. There's inference. You know, there's inference and presumption, and realizing there's not an elephant in the room. There are six basic means of knowledge that human beings utilize all of the time in order to give what we call jnana vrittis, knowledge vrittis, okay, that we can rely on. right? Because we're using an accurate and a valid means of knowledge to, and as long as that valid means of knowledge is functioning properly, you know, and the right conditions are there, then we can rely on that knowledge that we're receiving. That would be a knowledge vritti. We have other kinds of vrittis, also like emotions, imaginations, meditative experiences. There are many types of vrittis. Not all of them are born of a pramana. Some are like memories, are already there, stored in the unconscious. But they arise as a vritti. When they arise as a vritti, a thought modification, they are known. If they don't arise into the mind in some form or another, either through the means of a pramana, means of a knowledge, or through the function of memory, you know, or for the function of imagination, which can give content to the vritti, if they cannot be there in the vritti, they will not be known. Like, for instance, you have all kinds of stuff in your unconscious right now. You have a lot of memories. You have a lot of knowledge-born experiences. You know, you have emotions and complexes. There's many things that are abiding there in the unconscious, including unmanifest knowledge. That's why if I ask you to think of a tree, probably as soon as I've said the word tree, your tree image will come. And then I could say, think of another type of tree. But every time I do that, every time I ask that, or even say the word, like boat. Okay, a boat's there. Say the word tree is there. Say the word sun is there. It immediately comes into manifestation in my mind. But until I said that word, it's lying there in the unmanifest condition. In the psyche, again, emotions or complexes are just abiding there, you know, inactive, abiding there, unmanifest, until some trigger takes place, and then it comes into manifestation and is illumined by consciousness. But consciousness is required. The knownness, the self-evident nature of consciousness is required to come in contact with the content of that vritti, right? In order for that object to be known, it is not self-evident. It needs to come into consciousness in order to be known. The only thing that's not like that is consciousness itself. Consciousness does not need to come into consciousness to be known. And so the experience of knownness for every name and form, every experience that we have, actually does not belong to the object at all. The object is what we call jada. It's not self-evident. We can translate jada as inert. But really it means it's not self-evident, and therefore it requires a vritti, you know, in order to come into contact by means of the vritti with consciousness which reflects in the sattva. Okay, so then this thing is known, this is known, this thought is known, this thought is known. But without that, it has no self-evident shining. Whereas your nature is self-evident. It doesn't require coming into contact with anything in order for it to be known. It is the very knownness, the very consciousness is the word that we use, that I'm using within the world as knownness. It really is just self-evident consciousness, and we label it in our language as knownness. So just think of it like this. If I just go around the room, for instance, I can give you two common denominators, both of which are pointing to exactly the same thing. The first one is isness or being. It is. You have no experience whatsoever which is not. So the isness or being is a common denominator of absolutely, it's the invariable in every experience that you have. And it's not objectifiable. You can't say, well, look at the isness. And yet, the isness being is what we call the adhishtana. It's the very truth upon which all of these nama-rupas, all of these experiences depend on for their being. But it's not a thing in itself that you can look at. It's a thing that you are in terms of your own amness. It's the invariable. And that invariable of amness can't be separated from the invariable of knownness. Because if it is, say, in terms just of my limited experience as a jiva, it is. That isness will lock on to absolutely anything and everything that's experienceable. It is. And you know what else? It is known. Just take it from the standpoint of Ishwara. All is known. All is known. Ishwara is the invariable Sat-Chit conscious being, you know, which is the isness and knownness of the whole creation. But just for you as a jiva, it is known. Notice it is. So I can say, it is and it is known. It is and it is known. You try to have an experience which is not that, doesn't include that. That's the invariable. Okay? So the point of that little talk there is that the is-knownness or the knownness is self-evident and ever-present. I actually do not need to have a vritti or have the mind or the buddhi acknowledge my knownness because it's self-evident. But on the other hand, the buddhi has been suffering from ignorance and does not realize until it's taught, really, that existence is self, existence and existence consciousness is self-shining, self-evident. I don't even have an idea like that. What do you mean? Existence is self-evident, self-shining. How do we think like that? We don't. Okay? So when we, what happens is with this teaching, the buddhi, your mind, right? The intellect, if you want to say, buddhi is the best word. The one who really is gaining knowledge is the buddhi. It's the most innermost function of the mind because it can objectify everything else. It's also the most pervasive. So your buddhi, as it's being taught, is able to differentiate itself and its nature from the Sat-Chit, the conscious being, right, which can actually be recognized independent of the names and forms and thought modifications that the buddhi undergoes, or the manas, the fluctuating mind, undergoes. The buddhi can be taught to differentiate itself, right, itself from not only the different nama rupas that it can come into relationship with, it can also differentiate itself and recognize that it itself is known, that it itself is an object of awareness, that it itself is illumined, and that the luminary is something which is invariable in the vritti, as the vrittis go on, thought modification, as they go on changing. The luminary consciousness doesn't go on changing. I simply am the conscious being that is present to every vritti that takes place. So now the buddhi becomes aware of that. It becomes aware of the independence of the knownness of the conscious being that I am. It becomes aware that the consciousness is the invariable in all experience. So then it becomes a knower, as though, of that knownness, because it has, through the teaching, it differentiates it. Even though the idea of knower is not true, there is no experience of knower, but the buddhi is able to differentiate between the knownness that illumines it and itself as the one who is illumined. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's two things there. One is that consciousness itself is self-evident, and so that experience is ever-present no matter what the vritti is. And the other is that the buddhi can recognize that fact, because that fact is self-evident, and the buddhi can recognize and differentiate itself as the one who is illumined from the self-evident knownness, which is the invariable. Who knows if that was a good answer or not, but how come we humans get to know knownness? Okay, so there's another little thing there about we humans. Right? How come we humans? It seems that the other animal species don't require to become mumukshus. It looks that way. They don't require that. They don't seem to have a problem. It's the humans that have a problem. You know, because remember that this type of differentiation, it requires the mind to want to inquire into that. You know, and that actually, honestly, is quite unusual, even among humans, to have that desire to inquire, to know myself. But a human being can do it. We don't see animals, at least I haven't experienced my animals or any animals really having that need to do that. You know, many humans don't have the need to do that either. Mm-hmm. I remember I've told the story so many times that it was so kind of touching to me. It's when I came back from India and my parents picked me up at the airport and took me home. I hadn't seen them for several years. In fact, I saw my little sister. She had grown up into a teenager and all that. So they took me home, and I was kind of sitting in the kitchen talking to my mother about Vedanta. She asked me, just, what were you studying, honey? That type of thing. What were you doing there? And, oh, I was studying Vedanta. And then I started talking about it. And my poor mother, you know. Finally, she just said, oh, honey, I don't have those kind of problems. I just don't have those kind of problems. I don't think about those kind of things like that. I don't have that kind of problem. And she didn't mean anything mean about it or anything. She just didn't want to hear it anymore. So I realized that. You know. But animals don't seem to have that need. Also, they're more just, well, sometimes what I see with animals, fish, all living beings, except for humans, they seem to be much more in Ishwar Srishti. Ishwar Srishti means the objective, they're part of Ishwara. They didn't eat the apple, you know. You know, to bring about that kind of self-consciousness, that type of self-inquiry. They're very present, very intelligent. They have such deep, wonderful, beautiful emotions. They're so relational. They're so absolutely forgiving and present. And but when you're with them, it's like being, in a way, it's like being with Ishvara. It's like being with a conscious being who is simply present to what is and has beautiful, beautiful feelings, beautiful emotions. You know, and they don't hold a grudge on you either. You know, they're very, very beautiful and very loyal. They don't have certain confusions. I think they just kind of live instinctually within our dharma because they are Ishwara, just like all of us are Ishwara, but we have this buddhi that has free will, has developed free will. You know, so you can go against dharma. They don't have any inclination to go against dharma unless there's something wrong with them. There was something wrong with us. But anyway, they don't have that inclination. So they're in harmony. They're in such beautiful harmony. So I like people who are really dog trainers, animal trainers, who have really tried to really understand animals. If you're trying to teach your dog something, that really you have to teach yourself. Mm-hmm. It's about teaching yourself and how to relate with them so they understand what you're trying to say. And they're happy, very happy to please you. Yeah. So.
Can you say the difference between that and what a Mahatma has? Outlets or
a Mahatma, somebody who has self-knowledge, doesn't have much need to use their free will because the prarabdha karma is enough. The life that is unfolding is fine. And what's so great about that is you have it. You have your life. You have the prarabdha karma that takes you from your birth to your death. That's yours. So your life is completely taken care of, really, except you don't know that, and you're not happy. Right? You're not happy because you're projecting your ananda or your well-being out into the world, and then you're trying to get it, and you're not getting it. It creates all this kind of stress and tension. You know, desires are very problematic. Everything's fine until a desire arises. Mm-hmm. And then the whole world splits up into the thing I want out there, and the people that are helping me to get that, and then all my enemies who are really bad people. They're really not helping me. Mm-hmm. Something wrong with them. They're not kind, not supportive, you know. But these people over here are so good. And then there's, you know, the billion other people who I don't have any thought about at all. It's very problematic, these desires. They just create so much trouble. Because a desire, binding desire, right? Because a desire means I need this to be happy. That's what we mean. That's the desire template. Mm-hmm. I want this so that I can be happy. That's a big. So just think of it. I want X so that I can be happy, and X can stand for anything, right? Or the negative form of it is, I don't want X so that I can be happy. Mm-hmm. You know? The key word there is the happiness. What you're really saying is, I want to be happy. But now you're inserting this thing, I want X so that I can be happy. And then the mumukshu realizes that that formula will never work. And I still want to be happy, but that's the wrong formula. Because X is away from me, it's bound by time, whatever X is, it's away from me, it's bound by time, I'm bound by time, you can only line these things up. My desire and the object, you know, have to line up, and they have to stay lined up. Because what happens is, I want X so badly, so badly, so badly. Enemies and friends. Okay? Then finally, if I get X, it's a moment of joy, and then it kind of becomes, I have X. Oh my God, I've got X. How can I get rid of X?
I'll go to look after
it. Yeah. Oh gosh, what a joke. It's such a joke, really. This is so ridiculous. You know. But once you say, as you gain knowledge, you recognize that the ananda, that you're the wholeness, the fullness, the completion that you're trying to get from the world is really your own nature. But the nature, because it's always being experienced through the mind, your being, the wholeness of your being is being experienced through the mind, and the mind is very stressed and tense, you know, and so my ananda, my sense of well-being seems to come and go. Based upon the quality of the vritti in terms of its relaxation or its tension. So the tense vrittis are all of the negative emotions, depending on the nature of the tension in the vritti. Mm-hmm. One that's really stressed or tense is highly, highly depressed, you know. If we're not talking about chemistry, like from a psychological standpoint, there's such a thing as depression, which is a chemical imbalance. But there's just the regular human spectrum of emotions, the negative side and the positive side, right? And so we're comfortable with the positive side, and you can just notice the level of relaxation that there is in your mind and your body when there's some form of well-being there. And so what that calm or that shanti in the mind actually resonates with your own being. And so that's fine. I feel at home, I feel comfortable with all of those more relaxed type of thoughts. But the more stressed type of thoughts, I don't feel comfortable with, because they don't resonate with my being. And so they're like an invader. They're something I really need to work on. I need to get rid of that because I'm just isolated. I'm not myself. For a jnani, for somebody who has self-knowledge, it's a little different than that. because the negative spectrum and the positive spectrum, none of them actually touch my wholeness at all in reality, but that viveka, that discrimination is there. So I recognize my own being, and then these variety of vrittis on this whole continuum keep coming and going and coming and going. And sometimes they're negative or reactionary, and sometimes they're beautiful and quiet. But they're taking place in me, who I'm always fine, you know. So even though I would choose the kind of the relaxed mind that is kind of in harmony with Ishwara, really, it's in harmony with Dharma, I prefer that. Because then I'm in heart, I kind of just blend in with Bhagavan. The stressful ones are more problematic, but I'm fine. I am fine, but then I want to work on these because they're like, if I broke my arm, I would want to work on fixing my arm. And when my mind is in that kind of stressed or negative condition, I automatically want to bring it back into harmony with the whole, actually. Harmony with myself, read that it resonates with me, you know, that it belongs to me in a way, that it belongs to that it's an expression of Ishwara, without the entangled, it's an expression of Dharma, not an expression of Adharma. So, you have to just start contemplating or thinking about, because it's a beautiful thing, contemplation, that Dharma is Ishwara. Yeah. It's like the Dharma is the bones or the very structure, the very laws of Ishwara is Dharma. And so when I'm in harmony with that, my whole being is at peace. The same Shanti that is there for Ishwara is there for me. It's because there's no contradiction, you know. But when there's some sort of a Dharma that I'm having to deal with, then the ashanti is there. It's like I kind of am out of sync with myself. Myself in terms of the Ishwara Swarup, the whole Ishwara Upadi, and myself as the Satchitatma, the Ananda, my own being. I'm out of harmony with it from the standpoint of the Upadi. So when the Upadi is in harmony, then it's not unnoticeable, really. It's not calling attention to itself. It's just doing what it needs to do in whatever the circumstance is, whatever the moment is. You know, like a healthy body is not calling attention to itself as you're working, or eyes that have 20/20 vision. You don't always have to search around for your glasses, you know. Where are my glasses? A lot of us are doing that all day long. Where are my glasses? Where did I put down my glasses? Has anybody seen my glasses? So many of us. But say your eyes are 20/20. You never even think about your eyes. You just go looking at this and looking at that, reading this, reading that. Your eyes are just functioning, beautifully functioning instruments. If there is no true division between inner and outer, what accounts for my perception that I can raise my hand or direct my thoughts while the leaves in the wind outside move as they will? Well, first of all, there is an inner and an outer in reference to something which itself is outer. See what I mean? Like, let me explain. I think in reference to the Atma and the self, everything is objectifiable. So in reference to the self, everything is as though outer, right? Even what is inner, from the standpoint of the body, for instance, is inner means internal. It's internal to the body, like my mind and my sense organs, my imagination, the prana, the vital force. These are all considered as being inner to the physical body. And then all of this world that I perceive through my sense organs, other than the external of the physical body, is considered external. So then we got the inner and the outer. But from the standpoint of the Atma, the self, the inner and the outer are all outer. Mm-hmm. They in that they belong to Maya. Right? They're something which are all of it, the subject and the object, in terms of your what do you identify with yourself as the subject for you? Well, the body is identified as the subject, the sense organs, the body, mind, sense organs complex, this whole thing becomes the subject. Right? And then everything, so that everything from the body inwards is me, and everything from the skin outwards is something else. Right?
Somewhere around there. It's a little hard to figure out exactly where it's somewhere
around. Somewhere around there, yeah, exactly. But from the standpoint of the self, everything is outer. Mm-hmm. Right? Because everything is illumined. Then we look at this, then we get in the concept of what is actually outer. All we mean is that it's objectifiable. Mm-hmm. It can be objectified, and therefore it is outer. So even what is inner from the standpoint of the body is outer. Right? But everything that can be qualified as inner or outer exists within time and space.
I see. So would it be correct to say that the inner and the outer take place within Mitya?
Yes, take place within Maya, and Maya is Mitya. Mm-hmm. Just a little clarity there. When we say something is Satyam or Mitya or Tucham, Satyam means that which cannot be negated in past, present, and future. Mitya means that which has no independent reality. It's dependent on its being for something else. Tucham is that which is absolute non-existence. Satyam never changes. It's free from time. It's timeless. You know, Mitya is experienced but has no reality apart from, but is totally dependent on what is the Satyam for its existence. But it's experienced. Right? It's still a Sat. It's still non-existence from its own standpoint, but we experience it. And then Tucham is another order of reality that we say it is absolute non-existence. So when we say Satyam, Mitya, Tucham, we're talking about the order of reality that something enjoys. So Brahman, conscious being, its order of reality is Satyam. It can never be negated in past, present, or future. Maya, or everything that exists within time and space and the Ajnanam itself, you know, is what we call Mitya, because it has no independent being. It is subject to change. It comes into being and goes out of being. And so therefore it has no being of its own, because it comes from non-being and goes into non-being and has a little being in the middle. But nothing can come from non-being or non-existence, and so the existence that it's using, depending upon, is the Satyam. So Mitya is dependent upon Satyam for its being. But what is Mitya is an order of reality for everything that exists within duality, within Maya. And then Tucham is another as though order of reality, absolute non-existence, which doesn't exist. So it's not really an order of reality, but it's a useful tool. It's a useful tool in terms of delineating these various orders of reality that we give to Brahman, or the Atma, the Paramatma, as Satyam. We give to Maya, which includes Ishwar Srishti. Bhagavan, Ishwar's creation, the Lord's creation, the objective creation, which is called Vyavahara, empirical reality. Then we have the Pratibhasika. The Pratibhasika is subjective reality. That's Ishwar Srishti. I mean, Jiva Srishti. The Jiva's projections. Jiva Srishti. Vyavahara is Ishwar Srishti. The Lord's creation, the objective creation. You know. And then the Pratibhasika is our projection upon the Ishwar Srishti, Bhagavan's creation. But whether it's the Ishwar Srishti or Jiva, the Ishwar's creation or Jiva's projection and creation, that all of that is Mitya. So the Ishwar Upadhi is Mitya. The truth of Ishwar is Satyam. The conscious consciousness, conscious being is Satyam. And that satyam is free. This desha, kala, vastu, aparicheda. Desha is space, kala is time, vastu is quality. Yeah. And then aparicheda means not circumscribed or not limited by time or space or quality. Yeah. Or attribute. That is Brahman. Whereas everything within Maya is desha, kala, vastu, paricheda. It is limited by space. It's limited by time. It's limited by quality. And within the limitations of time and space, you know, it's subject to coming into being and going out of being. And so, therefore, it's mithya. The whole creation is, everything that exists within duality is mithya. It has no independent being. And there's many prakriyas that we use in Vedanta to make that understood, to make that seen. You know.
Can you elaborate on the word pramana and how that pramana flows through the teacher when this knowledge and vision is given?
Well, the word pramana actually, as we translate that in English, means a valid means of knowledge. The word prama means valid knowledge. Why do we say valid knowledge? Well, because in Sanskrit we have a word like prama, which means that the knowledge that you have is true to the object. That's a valid knowledge. But you could also have an experience like that we call mithyajnanam, which you're having a cognition, but the cognition is not true, like the cognition of a snake on a rope. You're having that cognition, but it's not true to the vastu, the thing that is actually there. So that cognition is called mithyajnanam, where if a pramana is properly functioning, then the vritti, the cognition that it gives you, is true to the object. On this plane of reality, on this level, we're not looking at staring at microbes or something. You know, then you need to have a microscope, and then you can, that is correct, functioning correctly, and then you can have a valid cognition of the microbe or the atom or whatever we're looking at. Yeah. Okay, so prama means a valid cognition which is true to the object. So that word prama is sometimes juxtaposed next to the word jnanam. And here, jnanam, when you have prama and jnanam, jnanam here, when it's juxtaposed with prama, means just any cognition. It could be true, it could be false. Like, say if you have, and they use an example in India, like what if your eyes are jaundiced? If you have jaundice, then they'll say, everywhere you look, it's yellow. And they think, how did the world become yellow like this? Yellow gas has been sprayed, or something. Yeah, because you're seeing everything yellow, but you're seeing it yellow because of the jaundice. Or something has happened with your eyes, and you look up, these are just stock examples, so you look up the moon. Oh my gosh, there's now two moons. You know, because your eyes are kind of crossed a little bit. And so you're seeing two moons. But two moons aren't there, you know. And so that's jnanam, that's a cognition which is really not true to what is actually there, where prama means the means of knowledge is working correctly in the proper, in a proper situation where it's allowed to work. You know, like for instance, there's one means of knowledge called anupalabdhi. It means the thing that I'm wanting to know I can't, is not there. Like, for instance, say I thought I left my keys on the table or on this, you know, stool. I left my keys on the stool. What? My keys are not on the stool. How do I know that? You don't know that through perception, because you can't perceive something that's not there, so it's not going to be perception. But it's perception plus something that will tell me. You know, there's another act involved there for me to know that my keys are not on that table. you know, or that there's no elephant in the room. But what if it's pitch black out? I can't even see the stool, let alone the keys. So I can't be looking around in the black and say, my keys aren't on the stool, when I can't even see the stool because it's black. So it's black, pitch black. So that's just a silly example, which is actually we use, of how the situation has to be right in order for a given means of knowledge to function. Okay? But what makes a means of knowledge a means of knowledge is that it functions as a pramana. It's able to give knowledge that is true of the vastu to the object. That's what makes it a pramana. It's actually able to do that. So the Advaita Vedanta is viewed as a pramana. It considers itself a pramana, a means of knowledge for knowing the self, for self-knowledge. It's the Upanishad pramana. It's considered a revealed knowledge that it comes with the creation in the form of the Vedas. And then the question is, well, how do I know if it's really a pramana or not? I'm not going to think it's a pramana just because it says it is. How do I know it is? Well, you can only know that it is by using it, because it's a pramana. It's like Swamiji uses the example of somebody who's been blind from birth. His eyes can't see. And a new surgery has come about. That's probably the surgery is one where you can remove cataracts. Maybe he was born with some kind of cataracts or something. And a surgery that they could actually do, a surgery that would remove those coverings on the eyes and he would be able to see. But the person has been blind all his life, and so he says, I don't want that surgery. You know, how do I know what makes me see? I don't have any shraddha, any faith that surgery is going to make me see. I don't want it. I don't even want to know about it. And so his family and everything is just beside themselves, thinking, please, please, they're begging him, please, please, you have to at least try this so that you can see. And the doctors are saying, you know, this has worked on many people. This will really... It's a very, very good chance of this working. He resists and he resists, and finally, just to keep everybody quiet, he agrees to have the surgery, you know. Then he has the surgery and his eyes are all bandaged, you know, bandaged for several days. And he doesn't care, he doesn't even want the bandages to come off. Because he has no shraddha that he will be able to see, you know. It's only when he finally agrees to use these pramanas, your eyes are considered a pramana, means of knowledge. All right, let me see. And now he agrees to use that pramana, to give that pramana, his eyes, a chance. Well, let's see if they can see. You know, let me see if they can see. So he uses the pramana and the eyes work. He can see. But how is he going to know whether he can see or not unless he uses the eyes to see if he can see? And so here, it's kind of, that's similar. Similarly, if the Vedanta, the Upanishads, which are considered to be a revealed knowledge and all of these things that scare people, especially in the West, revealed knowledge, oh please. All of these type of things. But that is what they say. That it is a revealed knowledge, and that it is a means of knowledge for knowing yourself. And so how will you know that it is or not unless you try it? But how can you try it out if you have no shraddha in it and no interest? You may not even be a mumukshu, you have no interest in trying it. But say you are a mumukshu, but you have no shraddha that teacher or that shastra, you know, the Upanishads, can deliver the goods. And so you'll never know, because you can't make yourself, or you're not drawn to utilizing that pramana. without using it, how would you know that it works? So that's kind of an interesting situation. But that's why they also say, I mean, certainly not everybody's a mumukshu. A mumukshu, one who really desires liberation, really desires to know who I am and what is this universe, that's not the most common desire in the world for, you know. I mean, most people don't think about that at all, and if they do, it just goes pshht. Then there's these few weirdo people, here we are, right here, who really, it really matters. I really do need to know. I have to know, I want to know. And so then, we say, and from kind of a, from a Hindu perspective, we'll say, well, Bhagavan's grace, that you even have that question, you know? And if that mumukshutvam is there, then just by the laws of the universe, you'll meet the teacher who can give you that knowledge. It's the promise of the Upanishads. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. I mean, that's it. And then we have the experience, I think you were maybe talking about, Tagadisha, is that the knowledge is really, let's say, it comes through the teacher, but what's coming through the teacher is what the students need to know and the order in which the students need to know. That's way too much for, nobody can plan that out. Gosh, what we'd have to be. It's not possible. And yet, the knowledge that comes out of the teacher is what the students need to know. You know, and so for this knowledge to take place, it's kind of the ego or the ahankar of the teacher can't be there, and the ahankar and the ego of the student cannot be there. It has to be that mind, the mind of the teacher and the mind of the student, are simply available, you know, for the flow of that knowledge. It's true, the teacher has to have that knowledge in order for that flow to come, but If the teacher is free in that way for that knowledge to come, and the student is free in that way for the knowledge to come in, then the mind of the teacher and the mind of the student are as though one mind, in a sense, because there's nothing in the way. And so that's why we have that experience of what the teacher is seeing, the student is also seeing. You know? What else was I going to say about that? And so all of us, almost everybody I know has always had this experience. I certainly had it all the time, and all of the other students that were studying would have it all the time. It's as though when Swamiji was teaching, it was like, oh, that's just what I needed to know. Or as a question would come up in your mind, that an answer would come. It happens all the time, you know? And it said, oh, that class is just meant for me. You know? But so many people are saying that. Mm-hmm. So that's not something that any human can plan that. It's something that takes place, you know? Like the teacher isn't going to be going, let me see, all that person needs that and that person needs that. Mm-hmm. There's no ego planning that. So there's something very, very special about this knowledge, about giving it and receiving it. It's a really the grace of, it's a Ishwara's blessing. Mm-hmm. It's a very special thing. That's what you meant.
The need for love and non-dual bhakti, like this self-involved kind of thing. This is,
what do you mean by non-dual bhakti? No, I seriously just want you to talk about it so I know what you mean.
Like a devotional feeling with something that's not outside of.
Oh, that's something that's your very being?
Yeah, like if one is sort of predisposed to have love kind of feelings or energy, there's not an object outside of this self to be devoted toward.
Well, there's, you know, just like say you recognize that for each one of these body, mind, sense organs, each one of these upadis, you know, though in so many ways we're different, and some people are more compatible with than other people, and all of this, these type of differences are all there, still there's only one self. The self that I am is the self that you are. And so even in the relationship between you as a limited being and Ishwara as the total, even though it's only one self there, which is me, still from the standpoint of the upadi, there is devotion to the whole. And then between you and me, me and the other, right, there's all different forms of love and hate. That's what's going on a mental, emotional level between two people, even though there's in fact only one self, right? And for Ajnani, the love is much more dominant than any kind of hate, because the Ajnani, the one who has self-knowledge, is not really asking, needing you to be in any particular way in order to love you. The love is actually just manifest in the self, manifest in the mind, which is not clouded or stressed by desire. But the only way the mind can be really free of desire to have fulfilled is to have fulfilled the desire. And to have fulfilled the desire, you have to come to the recognition that what the love that you're seeking is the love that you are. Mm-hmm. And that you really don't have to go anywhere for that. Mm-hmm. And so enjoying the love that you are, you can be with anybody. In the sense you can be with them as they are without needing them to be in a particular way, so that you can be happy. You see?
The love of Ishwara in terms of other people, like like the rug doesn't reflect I am, you know.
From its own standpoint, it doesn't.
But there's some kind of way that I could be with the world, like that exercise we were doing looking around. I want to know that in my whole experience, the sense of I am is relating to amness in a kind of...
The sense of I am is the amness.
So just resting in that, then love is happening. It's not like a relational...
Well, in fact, the love seems relational. It seems relational because being in your presence relaxes my mind and gives me a shantavritti, which then reflects the ananda of myself, right? Mm-hmm. And but so in a way it's illusory, but in another way, the prarabdha karma is such that brings me into contact with these people who give me shantavrittis, so that I can experience some ananda and happiness from the standpoint of the vritti, and also puts me in contact with people that give me, you know, ashanti vrittis, you know, agitated vrittis or hurt vrittis because of something that's happened within the relationship. That's all prarabdha karma. But for Jnani, those things are like salt and pepper, you know, the salt and pepper of experiences, because they don't change myself. And the more your knowledge becomes thorough, I would say, and that you've lived with your knowledge, your buddhi prefers to enjoying the ananda of your own being that you relate to the world. You know? Because there's no problem then. That means you're not asking the world to provide a particular situation for you so you can be happy. So that you literally... Please be like this for me so that I can have a shantavritti, so that my mind, so that the self can reflect in that shantavritti, so I can be happy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Really, all that a person needs to do is just be with yourself. We want like a ping pong ball or something. We want to go out here. Now, you all be like this. Because if you're like this, then my mind will feel fine and relaxed, and I will be happy, you know. But what if my mind doesn't need to go out here to have a situation created that can give it a shantavritti? I just go directly to myself. I just sit with my own being, which is the ananda that I'm seeking in the first place. Instead of having to try to ricochet off all of these objects, which is not successful. It's not really successful, but it can give momentary experiences of happiness sometimes and sometimes not. But no matter what, whether it gives it or not, if it creates the shantipati, it's still time-bound. What are you going to do about that? Momentary ananda. Woo-hoo. Not exactly what I'm wanting. Yeah. I'm falling asleep. What time is it? Oh, it's 9:30? Oh. Wonder. Okay. Say our prayer. Om Swasti Prajapet Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Gopramane Vyashivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Pavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Shobharahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukkha Bhak Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om.